Good evening. What a beautiful offering. Such largesse. Well, we're at the end of the Bodhicaryavatara. This last chapter, as I told you last week, is on wisdom, and it's so complicated that both the Dalai Lama and Pema Chodron have chosen to write a whole book on it. So there's no way to cover it in half an hour here. I can't imagine how they can write a whole book about it, frankly. Most of it is very interesting. In the Tibetan tradition, they have a big part of the monk's training is to have dialogues that look like arguments. I saw it in Dharamsala. They gather in a patio, and one of them elects to be the one sitting down who will be answering the questions, and the one standing up is very lively, and they slap their hands together very loud, and the standing up one shouts a question about Dharma, some very complicated question, and the guy sitting down has to answer it immediately. Bam, 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 like that. So you have all these people dancing around and screaming and yelling at each other. And it's a kind of constant testing that they do for themselves in order to get all the material down inside of them. And in a way, that's what this chapter is like, that except he's arguing with himself, and he brings up one kind of argument about what people believe, and then he says, yes, but how about this, 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 and this? And then the other side brings up another thing. So it's a big argument that's going on between Shantideva and all the various kinds of other ways of seeing how things are. He belonged to a school which is very like the Zen school. He's kind of a grandpa for us. Based on Nagarjuna's teaching that whatever you posit can be disproved. You can carry something all the way to the end, either positive or negative, but you can never pin anything down using logic. So that whatever you pick up can't be fully defined. So that's what the middle way means. That you don't go all the way to this side or this side. If you stay in the middle and hold them both. And the strange and interesting thing about the human mind is that although we tend to be dichotomous and wanting to choose one side or the other, we're actually able to hold both sides. Once we're able to recognize our ability to hold both sides, suddenly the world looks very different. We can actually entertain somebody else's contradiction without wanting to punch him in the nose. We can begin to see what comes to us in more than one way. Turn it round. Turn any idea around. Turn any relationship around. And begin to see how many almost infinite numbers of points of view there can be. It's also about, especially, how when you begin to think about yourself, how many different ways there are to think about oneself. And so Basically, the question is, what is the true nature of anything, including you and me? This is probably the most useful little book. Skilton and Crosby, Kate Crosby and Andrew Skilton, have very nice introductions. And they actually have a kind of explanation of the various arguments in here. And I've got a handout that might or might not be helpful. Thank you, Jane. As you can see, you can't really talk about wisdom without compassion. And as you know from reading Shantideva, Shantideva is one huge expression of compassion. In fact, the dedication at the end, which is, I suppose it's chapter 10, is a kind of enormous expression of compassion as a kind of follow-up to wisdom. It's the same as those first chapters when he wishes, fragrant baths and good food and happiness for all beings. In the end, he's wishing for the blind to see, and I mean, huge wishes of great heartedness, which comes from the compassionate, the wisdom view. There are actually two aspects of mind. The way we perceive usually the ordinary way is that there's me and everybody else. We've talked about this a lot of times. But as long as there's oneself and then everything else, we're all alone and isolated. It feels like that. Chogyam Trungpa talks about this in a very interesting way. He talks about when we wake up in the morning, that at first we don't know who we are. And how do we know? Because we see where we are. And then we remember, oh, this is me. And he said this is all kind of extra. We don't have to do that. We don't have to join into this is me and put on our story, though usually we do. Thomas Tranströmer is a Swedish poet who some of you may know, who wrote a poem about having taken a very long and exhausting car ride. And when it was night, he was so tired, he parked the car on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere and crawled in the back seat and went to sleep. And when he woke up, it was still dark. He not only didn't know where he was, he didn't know who he was. He had no idea. He said it was the most amazing feeling. It didn't feel bad. It was just, who is this? Who is this? Some of the great sages tell us as students that that's the question we should always be asking ourselves. Who is this? What is this? we chant the Heart Sutra and talk about the five skandhas. The five skandhas are the form of us, the form of anything, and then how it feels to be this, and then how it feels to take in information from our eyes and ears and nose, and then what we do about it, impulses we call it in our translation, how we begin to act, and then how we think about it. So suddenly, as Trungpa says, we're a kind of filter network through which, he says, energy is constantly being channeled and manipulated according to how we think about who we are. So as we take things in, we're always judging and deciding whether or not we accept it, and trying to make it fit with the idea we already have. So very often we end up with a kind of skewed notion of what's really going on. And that, Buddha says, is the source of our suffering. And it's not a hopeless situation at all, because it's just a total artifice. We talk about the ego and getting rid of the ego, but there's really no ego. It's just an idea. Just a cheap idea. Based on how we take in what our life is. How we live the energy of us. He says, rather than being able to flow freely. And we all have those moments when we flow freely, without thinking about what we're doing or who we are or whether we're doing a good job or a bad job, when everything just clicks and it goes. It's a lovely feeling. And it saves a lot of grief on both sides, our side and how we are with all the rest of us, which is everybody else. So that's why the whole point of the bodhisattva practice is that we work very hard to understand ourselves so that we can flow freely with all beings. And once we're freely flowing, it frees others to flow freely also. And we've all noticed that as well. When we come in a what we call a good place, it's amazing what an effect it has on other people. And so this Shantideva, great compassionate wish for and he expresses great sorrow for those who don't know about this, who haven't heard about it, or who don't understand it. So that actually these people call this perfection of understanding rather than perfection of wisdom. It's really both. And of course, all of this is based on meditation, this insight, and this understanding is based on meditation. It's not an idea, it's an experience. And the best description of it I know is this one. I think I've handed it out before, this long bit at the bottom by Ajahn Chah, who was one of the forest monks in the last generation in Thailand. Was it Thailand? I think. Very wonderful teacher. One of those extremely earthy, cutting through all the baloney right from the very beginning. And his description of the two kinds of what he calls peacefulness, of how to be with Zazen, which means how to be with everything else without fear. I hope you all look at this more than once, because I think it's very helpful, helpful for your sitting. He says there are two kinds of peacefulness. One is the peace of samadhi, and the other is the peace that comes through wisdom, through prajna. He says the mind that's peaceful through the practice of samadhi is still deluded. The peace that comes through the practice of samadhi alone is dependent on the mind being separated from mind objects. There's me, and then there's it, you, everything else. When it's not experiencing mind objects, then there is calm. And consequently, one attaches to the happiness that comes with that calm. However, whenever there is impingement through the senses, the mind gives in straight away. It's afraid of mind objects. One who is peaceful through samadhi alone is afraid of everything and doesn't want to get involved. He says, if the mind has achieved calm, then use it. Use the calm as the basis for contemplation. Contemplate the peace of concentration itself, and use it to connect the mind with and reflect upon the different mind objects which it experiences, rather than trying to protect ourselves, pull things in, push them away. To simply watch what's happening, to be very, very present to what's going on. Use the calm of samadhi to contemplate sights, smells, etc. If you simply enter samadhi and stay there, you don't gain any insight. You're simply making the mind calm, that's all. However, if you use the calm mind to reflect, beginning with your external experience, this calm will gradually penetrate deeper and deeper inwards until the mind experiences the most profound peace of all. The peace which arises through prajna is distinctive because when the mind withdraws from the state of calm, the presence of prajna makes it unafraid of forms, sounds, etc. It means that as soon as there is sense contact, the mind is immediately aware of the mind object. As soon as there is sense contact, you lay it aside. As soon as there is sense contact, mindfulness is sharp enough to let it go right away. This is the peace that comes through prajna. In other words, in the prajna mind, as it says in this little breakdown, you become your own authority. You don't let the world authorize you. You actually, that's the way you really are, is it happening first, and then you project and you create a world out there that then is determining who you are, and it becomes a very unsettling business, and we never feel really quite at ease. We're easily thrown off our balance because we're letting that balance us rather than having our own seat and our own balance from the beginning, from here, from where we are. So, as I said, it's a very complicated little bit at the end here. I'll read you some of Shanti David's wishes. Many, many wishes in the dedication. May the risk for animals of being eaten by each other go away. May the hungry ghost be as satisfied as the men of Uttarakuru. May the blind see, may the deaf always hear, and may expectant mothers give birth as did Maya Devi, free from pain. May those beings lacking in vigor be greatly invigorated. You can just think of all the things that you would ever wish for anybody, and he just put them all down. And then he dedicates the merit. I guess he dedicates the merit in the beginning, doesn't he? So that's a very, we've done this in about 10 weeks, I guess, because there are 10 pages. So it's brief. And I think we're going to study it again or some more. Is that the idea? In the study group.
Mm-hmm. Which everyone will hear more about.
Yes. Some people memorize pieces of this, and if you're interested, it's a nice thing to have inside you. Memorizing anything is always very helpful, but this is a good one because it's poetry, and so it's a little easier, and it's a very profound and complete embracing of the Bodhisattva way. Of how to be with all things. How to be willing to be with all things. So are there questions? Jewel?
How do you cultivate the willingness to be with all things? Because what I liked about the book is he also says that, you know, sentient creatures can also be like a little crazy or, I don't know, like troublesome even. How do you work with that?
Well, how he works with it is to take anything that's troublesome as especially valuable and helpful to practicing the paramitas of generosity and patience and vigor and all of those bodhisattva values. That he says, oh good, now I get to really practice if it's hard. So you especially appreciate anything that gives you a hard time. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, nobody ever promised that it would be easy. And it's not. Lead a really authentic life takes a lot of effort, which is why that's one of the paramitas, because it really does. It takes a lot of extra energy to do it. And one of our troubles is that we don't want to make the effort often and just want to glide along. And then we get into a kind of imaginary world, you know, where we're just trying to get by, and we bump into ourselves all over the place then. So we encourage each other to be as energetic as we can, just because it's so helpful. Sammy?
I'm not sure I understand the middle way. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit more about it. You said, you know, you don't have to go to this extreme or this extreme. Maybe be in the middle. But sometimes it feels like you kind of have to go, or at least me, just to experience that. So when I come back to the middle,
you know what it is. Yes.
Rather than just take it by faith.
Yes.
Is that right?
Sure. Sure. is talking more about it's a very intellectual part of our practice, really, when we talk about it in Nagarjuna's terms of trying to prove something. But when you're talking about how we act in our life, then you're right. The only way we know, except for when our mommy tells us, you know, or we begin to learn about the world, but much of our learning is about experiencing and then modifying our behavior and our understanding. It's about trying to understand how things are. So it's a kind of mind exercise rather than a on-the-ground one.
And is it truly always the middle way, or sometimes it's not the best way? I'm not sure I'm asking it right, but sometimes let's say back to the same subject, raising a kid, you're always, you know, okay, can't do this, we'll go in the middle, but sometimes you almost have to scream and explode to get their attention, and that's not going to be right, but it just seems to get through. It's like, wow, okay, I'll listen now.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I don't know, that might be a poor excuse, but, not excuse, but example.
I don't think that's what the middle way is about so much. It's how we think our way through. I'm trying to think how it would apply.
Could you explain the middle way as like the way things fall, like, nothing, when it comes down to it, nothing can stay at an extreme.
Yes.
For long. It always, like, Stephen Hawking described the universe as kind of like a bowl.
Yes.
Like, when it comes down to it, where things travel, how things go. And, like, in terms of human interaction, like, when things are suppressed with people, maybe, like, people then have to yell at some point to get it. That's the way things fall in that particular interaction.
To write the balance.
Yes.
Yes.
Things.
Yes.
To balance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, Jesus did it at one point. He got so pissed in the temple, he just started, you know.
Yep.
I mean, he probably did it once or twice.
Yeah. That we know about.
But again, that's not the middle way. We're not talking about that.
Well, you can apply the middle way that way. I think Donna Lynn nailed it pretty well, because it's always really talking about the present moment. So whatever is the most, and then if you try to analyze the present moment and figure it out and decide whether it's, you know, life enhancing or not, or good or not, any of those ways that we divide things up, you can't, it's about that way that our mind works, that if you're deciding good and bad, you can't come to a conclusion. The only thing you can do is to sit in the middle of the question, in the middle of the present moment. So you and Maya are in the middle of your present moment, whatever is happening. And it keeps changing. So, and that's one of the things that keeps us from getting feeling stuck and getting mixed up is when we allow it to change, allow it to flow, and not insist on it being exactly the same moment by moment, but let it go and be what it wants to be.
And would you know if it is you're doing it?
No, you don't know it. You just live as best you possibly can and pray for the best. Well, it's 8 o'clock.